Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's been 40 years since Richard Nixon first tried to get us off foreign oil. How are we doing on that? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Good to have you here on this Wednesday, everybody. It's the 2nd of March today. And should you have wanted to purchase a barrel of crude oil this morning at the New York Mercantile Exchange, it would have set you back $102.23. The trouble in Libya is the immediate cause, but every time a squeeze like this happens, we start hearing about our dependence on foreign oil. A long line of presidents has bemoaned our addiction, so why haven't we been able to break the habit? Sarah Gardner reports now from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk. It's because we haven't really wanted to.
Okay, it's not exactly that we don't want to get off foreign oil. Richard Nixon certainly did, or at least he said so, in 1973 after the Arab oil embargo.
Let us set as our national goal that by the end of this decade, we will have developed the potential to meet our own energy needs without depending on any foreign energy sources.
Later presidents may not have made that particular slip of the tongue, but they echoed the sentiment. Listen to George W. Bush in 2007.
Tonight, I ask Congress to join me in pursuing a great goal. Let us build on the work we've done and reduce gasoline usage in the United States by 20% in the next 10 years.
Not as ambitious a goal as Nixon's, but Bush told us it would cut oil imports substantially. And imports have fallen in recent years, thanks in part to homemade biofuels. But imports still make up half of all the oil we consume. We still use lots of gasoline, and we expect it cheap. That's partly why Congress would rather drink diesel fuel than raise gas taxes. And Bob Deans at the Natural Resources Defense Council says the oil industry likes it that way.
If you look at the top five largest privately owned oil companies, they made $950 billion in profits just over the past decade. And these companies take care of themselves. Here in Washington, they are served by an army of lobbyists almost 800 strong.
But it's not just our expectations of cheap gas and oil industry muscle. Rice University's Amy Myers Jaffe says we've also pandered to the auto industry. Reached at an energy conference in Tokyo, Jaffe says we could have asked a lot more of car makers.
And it's really disgraceful because other countries have had a very proactive policy. There are better efficiency and mileage standards in China than there are here in the United States.
But our dependence on foreign oil also stems from our reluctance to produce more here at home. We've restricted our offshore drilling out of concern for the environment, and rightly so, said critics following the BP disaster. Those same critics say we've also skimped on research funding for alternatives to petroleum. But oil expert Philip Verlager believes there's a reason for that.
The government has proven to be horrible at picking winners.
So, is Nixon's goal of U.S. energy independence a mere dream? Daniel Yergin is author of The Prize, The Epic Quest for Oil, Money, and Power. He says energy independence has always been an elusive goal, given our lifestyle and the breadth of the American economy, until we all start driving cars fueled by some economical alternative to oil. Yergin argues we should set more practical goals.
Diversification of where our supplies come from, increased efficiency of automobiles, and a balance between domestic production and imports.
Which we might have by 2016, when automakers have to meet new fuel efficiency standards, albeit not near as tough as Europe's or Japan's. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Stocks did a little dance with those rising oil prices today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Treasury Department said the other day it's frozen about $30 billion worth of Libyan assets. Other countries have done the same thing. Among all those commingled piles of money are the holdings of the Libyan Investment Authority, Tripoli's sovereign wealth fund. Lots of countries have them. Essentially, they're the disposable income that commodity and foreign currency-rich countries have to play with. Those funds have been around for a while, but they have been higher profile the last couple of years, as Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
Sovereign wealth funds have made some pretty high-profile investments lately. In 2007, for instance, the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority came to the rescue of Citigroup with an investment of $7.5 billion. Besides banks, these funds have bought into all kinds of ventures, the department store Barney's, Cirque du Soleil, the Chrysler Building. There are about 50 sovereign wealth funds globally, mostly from commodity-rich countries. Ted Truman is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He says the goal of these funds is to diversify their country's wealth.
These countries essentially dig their oil up out of the ground and they sell it and then they invest it for future generations.
Some non-oil producing countries also have sovereign wealth funds. China and Singapore, for instance, use them to invest their large foreign currency reserves. Governments don't have to disclose precise details of their sovereign wealth funds, but estimates suggest that around the world they hold about $4 trillion. Some recent investments by these government-controlled funds from the Middle East and China have raised concerns about political motives. Ashby Monk is co-director of the Sovereign Wealth Fund Project at Oxford University.
You know, these funds, oftentimes in the U.S. context, they're kind of viewed with suspicion, and they're viewed in sort of a negative light in terms of their investment operation.
He says we tend to forget the other side, that the funds say they're about business, not politics, and that unlike a lot of investors, these funds are in it for the long haul, which is why U.S. companies have been interested in wooing them. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
There was a big shakeup today in the world of microfinance, the business of giving tiny loans generally to poor people in developing countries. Mohamed Yunus, the Nobel Peace Prize winner and a pioneer in the field, is said to have been ousted from Grameen Bank in Bangladesh, the microfinance bank that he founded 30 years ago. David Rudman is a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development. We've called him up to get some insights on this. David, good to talk to you.
Great to be here.
So what has happened in Bangladesh between Mohamed Yunus and the government?
Well, a rumor went out today that Mohamed Yunus had been fired, which technically is not true because the only people who can really fire him are the board of the Grameen Bank, and they don't want to do that. But it's clear that the government wants to get rid of Yunus, and I'm thinking increasingly that they will succeed.
Why do they want to get rid of him? He is, you could fairly say, the founding father of microfinance.
Well, for the Prime Minister of Bangladesh, Sheikh Hasina, this is a serious political game. She comes from a long-established political family with a brutal history. And she sees Mohamed Yunus, because of his fame and stature, as a potential rival.
And he has been saying unkind things about the government. He's accused them of corruption and all kinds of different things.
Well, yes. Back in 2007, he said once or twice that politicians in Bangladesh are corrupt, which actually happened to be true. But that's kind of the extent of it.
This whole thing in Bangladesh, though, plays into the larger question of what has become of microfinance. I think the last time a lot of people checked, it was the salvation for poverty in the third world. And now there are suicides in India. There are talks of extortion in South America. I mean, it's a little bit has changed in the past couple of years.
That's right. A lot has been going on. And I think what's happening in Bangladesh, although it is primarily a domestic political struggle, is a symbol because it raises this big question, can microfinance survive its own success? And what's happened is that it really is doing good on the ground. It's providing useful services to millions of people, but it's also been oversold. And now there's a kind of backlash, both because people are finding out, well, actually, maybe it isn't a proven weapon against poverty, and also because it has motivated such a flood of capital into microcredit that it has led to overlending and overborrowing in a story that's very familiar to Americans.
Yeah, sounds a little bit like subprimes.
Exactly. In fact, Yunus has called it something like subprime lending. I don't think he meant it quite that way.
Yeah. Well, so are we going to see in microfinance the same thing we've seen in, I suppose you might say, macrofinance, right? Subprimes and the rest of the banking global economy. This pulling back and a retrenching and a tightening up of standards and maybe not so much microcapital out there?
To an extent, I think we will, and I think that that would be a healthy thing. I mean, one big difference here is that the microcredit sector is not systemically important. If it all collapses tomorrow, that won't create a recession. So the issue here is just how to make this little part of the economy in certain poor countries work better so it can really serve poor people more. And I think we're at a point where actually less money going in might actually make things work better because then the growth would be slower and safer.
Is what's happening in Bangladesh going to change anything on the larger microfinance world? I mean, Muhammad Yunus is having problems. Bangladesh is upset. But microfinance will continue.
Yes, I think microfinance will continue because what matters on the international stage is that Muhammad Yunus will still be a hero. This is not really undermining his reputation or the reputation of microcredit.
David Rudman is a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development. David, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
I saw a study this morning that gave me pause. A poll by the Terrence Group. It's a company that's worked with a lot of Republican politicians. It shows big majorities of Americans, upwards of 60%, have no idea where the government spends most of its money. The government gets a lot of the money it spends by borrowing. And pretty soon, that ability to borrow, the debt ceiling, it's called, is going to run out. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale explains the next big hiccup coming for the federal budget.
The debt ceiling limits the government's authority to borrow money. Congress has currently set it at $14.29 trillion. The U.S. could hit that limit as early as April. Some lawmakers think it's time to draw the line and stop government borrowing. But lots of economists say that would be a catastrophe, since the government couldn't pay the interest it owes holders of existing debt. The U.S. would be defaulting on what are supposed to be ultra-safe Treasury bonds. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke warns that's a dangerous prospect.
And if the United States defaulted, it would have extraordinarily bad consequences for our financial system, and it would mean that we would face higher interest rates essentially indefinitely because creditors wouldn't trust us to make our interest payments.
Without that trust, investors might bolt and the U.S. would have to pay higher interest rates. University of Texas economist James Galbraith says all Americans would feel the pinch.
It would weaken the position of the United States in world financial markets, and it would tend to affect the standard of living of Americans as well because it might push the dollar down.
The only way to avoid raising the debt ceiling is to run a balanced budget. Otherwise, the U.S. has to keep borrowing to make interest payments on the debt it already has. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
There are reports out of Wisconsin today suggesting a very slight thaw in the political standoff there. One of the absentee Democratic senators apparently crossed back over the state line on Monday to meet with a Republican leader in the Senate. They talked, but apparently that's about it. Disagreements over pay and benefits for public employees are spreading, as you know. They're front and center in the budget debates in Ohio and Indiana as well. Commentator David Frum has this take on what the discussion ought to really be about.
What's at stake in Wisconsin? The New York Times reports the story of the Juvenile Detention Center in rural Manitowoc County on the shores of Lake Michigan. That center costs about $350,000 a year. It currently holds one inmate. The county executive has proposed closing the center and paying another county to hold the single inmate. Seems sensible, right? So why has it not happened? Answer, a union work rule. The relevant contract forbids the county to do any subcontracting if unionized workers have been laid off. So, unless the county can find other jobs for the six juvenile detention center workers, the county cannot contractually pay another county to store its lone inmate. Wisconsin's public sector unions have been getting an impressively good time from the media in their battle with Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. Reporters correctly note that the unions have offered concessions on pay and benefits to help the state close its current budget gap. That seems reasonable, even conciliatory, if the pay and benefits were the main issue. But the issue is not primarily pay, nor a one-year budget gap. The issue with public sector unions has always been work rules. Even under the best of circumstances, government is rigid, slow to adapt. Politicians chase votes, not profits from cutting costs. And unionized employees vote. Remember how hard it was to close redundant military bases? So what's at stake in Wisconsin? It is the ability of public sector managers responsibly to streamline state and local workforces that have grown by more than 50% over the past three decades. Union work rules make government even more sluggish and add that much more weight to the burden on state and local taxpayers at a time of fiscal crisis.
David Frum was a speechwriter for the second President Bush. Today, he's the editor of Frum Forum. Next week in this space, Robert Reich. Sometime before then, we hope your comments. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact. Coming up, those clothes you're wearing, think for a second about the fabric that didn't make the cut.
If you say to any industry, we can help you to not waste 15% of your raw materials, they'll be all over it.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials edged up less than a 10% today. That's 8 points, ended at 12,066. The blue chips did. The NASDAQ picked up a 3%, 10 points, 2748 at the bell. The S&P 500 climbed a 10%, 2 points, finished at 1308. Good news from the Fed today. The Beige Book said the economy is gaining strength, and that softened the impact of another rise in oil prices. Financial shares were mixed on the mix. Bank of America dipped 0.6%. Citigroup rose 0.6%. J.P. Morgan Chase fell 0.75%, and Morgan Stanley gained about 0.5%. Up, down they went. We got a look at the new iPad today and at Apple CEO Steve Jobs. He came out of medical leave to make the announcement. The combination lifted Apple shares more than 0.75%. Microsoft down about 0.3%. Google shares ended the day right where they began. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.47%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, President Obama meets with President Calderon of Mexico at the White House. Chain stores report sales data for the month of February. And the National Transportation Safety Board concludes a 3-day hearing on the natural gas pipeline explosion that occurred last September in San Bruno, California. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
A whole lot of you wrote this week about my interview with Bill Gates. Among other things, he suggested that teachers might be willing to take on bigger class sizes if you paid them just a little bit more. Carrie Johnston teaches elementary school in East Oakland, California, and she could not possibly disagree more.
I know he's a billionaire, but he is not a teacher, and he has no idea of the difference between teaching 20 and 36-year-olds who have very diverse needs, from those who can read 120 words a minute to those who don't speak a word of English, to those who are struggling with learning disabilities.
Joel Patterson of Cambridge, Massachusetts, meanwhile, questioned Gates' assertion that student improvement has been flat. He says the numbers from a study called the National Assessment of Educational Progress just don't lie.
For 9-year-olds, the averages in math from the 1970s to 2008 among white students is up 25 points. Among black students, up 34 points. Among Hispanics, up 32 points.
Lisa Dunn's a teacher and soon-to-be mom in Silver Spring, Maryland, and she wrote about David Leonhardt's commentary on how companies can profit by helping women like her balance work and family.
I'm astounded by the lack of support that exists in U.S. society. A mere search of comparable workplace family policy around the world shows that the United States has lacked to progress in the way that so many other less economically powerful nations have done.
Finally, from Danielle Barboza of Glen Cove, New York, a simple question. At the end of the numbers every day, when I talk about the 10-year T-note and where the price and yield wound up that day, what is that? She wanted to know. The short answer is that it's a bond issued by the Treasury Department on which investors collect interest. The trick is that with those bonds, IOUs really, that they can be bought and sold on the open market, which affects the yield or interest rate. And the reason we talk about it is that it's kind of the benchmark for the whole bond market, and the bond market, in turn, can be a pretty good way to tell how the whole economy is expected to do. So if you've got a note for us, you can drop it to us on our website, marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. I'm going to bring up a familiar name now, Christopher Dodd, as in former Senator Christopher Dodd. He's so recently gone from Congress that lawmakers are still trying to figure out how to enforce the last big bill he worked on, Dodd-Frank, the financial reform package. But we're not here to talk about any of that today. The ex-senator has a new job. He's gone to Hollywood, not in that Dancing with the Stars kind of way, but in the lobbying way. He's the new head of the Motion Picture Association of America. And Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports he's going to have more to do than just hang out with famous and rich people.
Chris Dodd is no stranger to the movies. Here he is playing himself in the political comedy Dave.
I think putting people to work in this country is what we ought to be doing. It's far better to have someone with a job than collecting a welfare check.
Dodd's new bosses wouldn't mind if he stayed in character. Marty Kaplan is a professor at the University of Southern California. He says Dodd will need considerable political skill to represent the six major movie studios.
It's not always true that the interests of all the studios align, so that on issue after issue, it's a question of negotiating compromises and herding cats.
Those issues are likely to include piracy, intellectual property, and fees for content from cable providers. Edward J. Epstein is the author of The Hollywood Economist. He says the government has a role in much of that.
And this is where a U.S. senator could be most effective at lobbying.
Media management professor Nelson Gayton says the MPAA doesn't have the clout it once did, and Dodd will face challenges.
They selected someone who doesn't seem to have the policy experience in intellectual property, which is probably one of the top things on their agenda.
But Marty Kaplan says Hollywood and Washington are all about power and illusion.
So it's a perfect fit between two myth-making factories.
Dodd starts his new role later this month. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
So let's see. We've got sustainable energy and sustainable manufacturing, sustainable agriculture and sustainable construction, clothing that's easy on the planet? Not really. So some big clothing manufacturers and retailers have formed a new trade group called the Sustainable Apparel Coalition. They want standards for every single garment sewed and sold, every piece of fabric, every zipper, every manufacturer along the supply chain, and then an easy-to-understand scorecard for consumers so they can see at a glance the environmental impact of a single piece of clothing. Adrian Hill reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk. Step one is cutting down on scraps.
I'm assuming most of you are not listening naked, so look down at what you're wearing. Chances are at least 15% of the fabric that went into that t-shirt or jacket or pair of jeans wound up on the cutting room floor.
Which is a colossal and tragic waste of fabric.
Simon Collins is the dean of the School of Fashion at Parsons in New York City. He says reducing waste in the production of garments is better for the environment, but that's not the reason he expects it to catch on broadly.
I think if you look at the rise in the price of cotton, if you say to any industry, we can stop you, we can help you to not waste 15% of your raw materials, they'll be all over it. You know, maybe they couldn't care less about sustainability, but they certainly care about their bottom line.
So at Parsons, students have been working on zero-waste garments. Think of it like rolling out cookies and figuring out how to cut interesting shapes without wasting any of the dough. It's not easy. And reducing waste like this requires a significant rethink of how clothes are put together. Fashion designer Carol Young shows me around her workroom. An assistant cuts big, curvy pieces out of some black knit fabric for a dress.
And then we had these big areas that didn't have anything. So we thought, oh, we can do our cloud scarf. So we put those pieces in there, and then it uses up the whole piece.
By using up the extra fabric, she creates extra products she can sell in her little Los Angeles boutique. For Young, creating less wasteful clothes is part of her design philosophy. For shoemaker Nike, it's part of the business model.
We know that in the future there are declining resources and increased demands on those resources. And so we know we have to create products in a completely new way.
Lori Vogel heads up Nike's Considered line of more environmentally friendly products. She says the company's been successful at reducing waste, this year saving the amount of material it would take to make the uppers of 15 million pairs of shoes. Nike's also started recycling plastic water bottles into fabric, and in case you're curious, it takes about 8 bottles to make a jersey.
We don't want to just be less bad. What we'd like to do is really paint a vision for what good looks like. And for us, that's all about creating closed-loop products. So our vision is to take materials from an old shoe and an old shirt, grind them up, and turn them into a new shoe and a new shirt.
A closed loop means that every new product is made from old products without any new inputs. It's a concept of fashion sustainability which allows us all to keep buying, to get that new pair of shoes we've been drooling over without feeling bad about it.
It's about creating new products, which create jobs, and creating them in a way that has as little environmental impact as possible.
Susanna Schick is a sustainability consultant for the fashion industry. She says using less to make new garments and using recycled materials makes a lot of sense when you think about sustainability as an economic as well as environmental concern.
A lot of sustainability-minded people are all about just wear the same thing forever, just buy something and wear it forever, buy used, you know, buy secondhand. But that's not going to create jobs. You know, it's not going to create jobs here, it's not going to create jobs in China, Africa, anywhere people make clothes.
And it's a way forward that's maybe more inspiring than wearing the same black dress over and over and over and over. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, some perspective on the unemployment report we're going to get Friday morning. Derek Thompson at The Atlantic Magazine likes to think of the labor market this way. Companies have cut the equivalent of Virginia since the recession started in December 2007. The entire populations of Virginia, Colorado, and Rhode Island are unemployed. The entire metro areas of Chicago and Los Angeles have been unemployed for 6 months or more. And the workweek population of Washington, D.C. has just plain given up looking for work. 8:30 Friday morning, Washington time, for that jobs report. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. That's APM. Today, the Dow edged up 8 points, less than a 0.1%. The NASDAQ picked up 10 points, about a 0.3%. The S&P 500 climbed 2 points, a 0.1%. Fahad Baladouni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time, back here, for all the billions of dollars in Russia lost to alcoholism, one trip to the clinic promises a cure.
I don't know how it worked, but it did work for him because he hadn't drunk till the rest of his life.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.